Good morning, everyone. Today, myself and my colleagues, Ailey and Olivia, and the Quokka. I will just note, though, the Quokka and myself feel a little bit excluded. I feel like we didn't quite get the matching dress code memo. But alas, I digress. Today, we will talk to you about Australia's digital health platform, My Health Record, that has seen significant government spending over the last 10 years to share patient data and expand healthcare through blended care pathways. In this presentation, we will touch on the foundation of what My Health Record is and how it came to be, outline its key issues, and the various reasons and concerns for private health insurers gaining access, all to lay the groundwork for the opportunities that we have identified that we believe are grounded in both being practical and impactful. The first step at looking at My Health Record is to naturally cover what is My Health Record. It's been officially defined as a safe and secure place to keep your key health information that's available to you and your healthcare providers anytime, including in an emergency. When we unpack this, the first major point to consider is security. And given the information present in any sort of health record, security is of paramount concern. My Health Record fundamentally tries to accomplish this by being a federated identity model that stores data on independently managed Australian servers and employs a range of technologies to protect the sensitive information, such as firewalls, audit logs, antivirus scanning of documents, with ongoing system monitoring for suspicious activity. Given the nature of independent data repositories, My Health Record's design is more secure than a centralised database solution due to not having a reliance on a single point of failure. In saying this, one of My Health Record's core problems has been in relation to data security, which Ailey will speak to in a later section. Something I'll discuss in greater detail in the next slide, but originally, My Health Record began as an opt-in system, but due to a significant lack of uptake amongst the community, it was transitioned to an opt-out model that naturally saw a significant increase to the participation. But who exactly is able to see the information in My Health Record? Turning our attention to the right-hand side of the slide, My Health Record is accessible by healthcare recipients who can view it online through MyGov or the app itself, and healthcare providers who can upload, view, and share health information, subject all to the access controls set by the healthcare recipient. This diagram shows the interactions within the My Health Record system and the type of data that can be stored and uploaded there, ranging from clinical information, such as event and discharge summaries, electronic referrals, and prescription records, to consumer-entered information, such as personal health summaries on allergies, next of kin details, and emergency contact details. All the while, there's the external injection of Medicare and PBS data, which contains things like your immunisation records, Medicare or PBS claims information, and organ donor information. And again, to reinforce, all the while being ultimately controlled by the individual's appetite for provider access. When looking at My Health Record, it's important to consider the lengthy timeline that it's gone through to be implemented in the Australian sort of health ecosystem. Going as far back as 2012 saw the launch of what was then dubbed the Personally Controlled Electronic Health Record, a bit more of a mouthful, and this delivered the core functionality that was required to grow over time and with the aim to place the individual at the centre of their own healthcare. Moving then to 2013 to 2015, still early on, issues started to become prevalent in regards to information security that were flagged in review reports and has been an ongoing part of the My Health Record discourse to date. 2016 saw a pivotal shift in terms of this is when we started thinking maybe moving from an opt-in model to an opt-out model was required. And as a result of the low participation in, again, what was then dubbed PCEHR, it was providing little value. The opt-in model design was clearly not working. In late 2015, an amendment to the My Health Records Act was passed and enabled the system to operate on an opt-out basis. This was to be trialled and only rolled out nationally if they resulted in increases to participation at a level that provided value to My Health Record. And these trials were taking place in 2016. Moving to 2018, which is where we saw the official transition to an opt-out model and the official renaming of the platform to My Health Record. There then suddenly appeared several articles that talked to the desire for private health insurance to want to gain access to de-identified data from the platform. which was, of course, completely unsurprising, given it was now a three-letter acronym and PHI doesn't already have enough of them. This is something that Olivia will talk to in greater detail. Moving then to 2019, saw the implementation of the My Health Records Amendment Bill for various changes that, when we summarise it, essentially allowed the use of de-identified data for research or public health purposes, provided there is compliance with the governance standards, which, despite this bill passing in 2019, is still something that's contentious to this day. Another key and pivotal point in My Health Records timeline is looking at 2020 to 2023, where My Health Record, intended as the digital source of truth for an individual's healthcare information, saw a surge in use as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. As such, this led to an enhanced understanding, particularly by consumers, of the practical benefits that digital health practices can deliver through the tracking of COVID vaccinations and other things like that. Looking now at the current snapshot of where we are, 2024, 99% of GPs and pharmacies use My Health Record. However, only around 50% of pathology reports and 1 in 5 diagnostic imaging reports are uploaded to My Health Record, and typically have a long lag between the provider uploading the reports and the individual or the GP being able to view it on the platform. The goal for the end of the year is expected that legal obligations for pathology reports providers to upload results will be in place, with work being done to ensure that there is minimal lag between the time of upload and when the consumer or the GP is able to view the documents. As a final point on the timeline, we look ahead to the short-term future with the roadmap set forward by the Australian Digital Health Agency that targets 4 key outcomes. The first of which is the desire for a connected and safe health system, which is underpinned by moving the health system to near real-time data exchange to deliver efficient, responsive, and effective healthcare, and also by building the digital capacity, competency, and maturity of the health force. The second outcome that's targeted is empowering the Australian people to take command of their healthcare by equipping them with the right tools to do so. And thirdly, the inclusivity and accessibility outcome that supports equitable health access to all Australians is to be achieved by the improvement of the virtual care pathway. The last outcome is having readily available information to inform decision-making at the individual, community and national levels that culminates in a sustainable health system. This is an outcome that shares similarities with many topics that have been covered thus far in the summit, such as planning for emerging technologies and embracing advancements to support greater system efficiencies, whilst ensuring the necessary regulatory and ethical frameworks are adhered to. Using digital health tools to collect, analyse and report health information to support quality improvements to healthcare and patient-centred outcomes. I'll now pass to Ailey to talk through the major problems that My Health Record has faced over the years and is still facing today.
Thanks, Adam. And no, Olivia and I did not plan to wear the same outfit, and yes, it does happen more than you would think. But I am now going to talk about the problems with My Health Record and what went wrong. As has come up a little bit in what Adam has said, some of the biggest challenges in the early days were around data security, and I think this has been quite a common theme both across the summit and in our industry in general. In the early days, the biggest issue was getting people to opt in, getting them to trust the system. I think that has been substantially addressed, particularly with those trials that Adam talked about and the switch then to opt out. There is now pretty decent usage and pretty decent uptake at the patient level. Some of the outstanding data security challenges now are more of the edge cases, so it's emergency access. So what is what are the ground rules for that? How can people access this when the patient isn't in a position to give consent? There are some challenges, or certainly they want to tighten some of the legislation prohibiting access for employment or insurance-related reasons, some of which Olivia will touch on. There are still some question marks or some things that need to be addressed around the treatment of records for deceased individuals or minors. So, for example, you know, what happens with 16-year-olds? Can their parents get access to these records? Now, there's been quite a few reviews in synthesising a lot of this. We looked at some work from the National Audit Office and from the Department of Health. And by and large, the assessment is that these things are substantially addressed. The ones I've listed are edge cases and things that it's more around cleaning up legislation, tightening up a lot of these little things. But fundamentally, the system is there now. There is a level of trust in that and an understanding that the data security part has been addressed. So I'll spend a little bit more time on the other two. One of the biggest issues is uptake. So Adam has mentioned GPs are using this at quite a high rate. About 98-99% of GPs are using that, and there's information in there from those consults. But other services, it's much lower. Now, part of that has been that the system scene is quite clunky. So it's quite, I think it's sort of a bit low-tech, hard to use. For GPs, there's tools that integrate that with their practice management software, for example, so that has made it easier, and that will be part of why that uptake is higher. But for other providers, that doesn't seem to have been something that has occurred yet. With some of those future initiatives, with some of that planned integration with other systems, that's where there is a lot of opportunity and something that it will focus on. There's also been a mixture of sort of carrots and sticks trying to get people to use the system. So there's been incentive payments for providers. But it looks like that'll actually transition now more to the stick side of things, where it is now mandatory. They must upload the records. There was a little bit of a stoush last year with some of the pathology providers in terms of mandating that, and some of them then not achieving the targets that were set for them. But a lot of that is being worked through. It's pathology and diagnostic imaging now, and then that may extend then to other types of providers going forward. This is something where in the last budget, we are just on the eve of the next one, but in the last budget there was $430 million that was being invested to actually deal with this. So to make the system easier to use, to give a pathway forward in terms of the right calibration of incentives. But this is something that's going to have to continue to be worked on to really broaden the pool of data that's going into this and making it a worthwhile source of information. And sort of by extension, the real value of My Health Record is going to be when it's not just a digital filing cabinet. It's an integrated tool. It's bringing in information from different providers, and it is then using that information for a purpose, which is something Olivia will also talk on a little bit. Right now, I don't know if any of you have actually looked at your My Health Record recently. Maybe when you were like looking at COVID vaccine info, or like Adam said as well, if you're looking, you know, going into MyGov and sort of seeing it's there when you're doing your tax return. At the moment, it's pretty sparse. It's lists of consults. You may be able to see some test results in there. That's about it. It needs to actually be a tool that uses that information as well, or helps that information be integrated with other systems. That's something we'll talk about some of the opportunities with going forward. But with that, I'll pass to Olivia, who'll talk a little bit about private health insurance and My Health Record.
Thank you. Ailey and Adam stole my outfit joke, so I'm just going to get straight into it. So Ailey spoke about the desire for My Health Record to be more than just that kind of digital filing cabinet, and opportunities to link up to other digital health initiatives and improve value for both consumers and providers. So I'm going to pick this up from a PHI point of view and cover some of the concerns around why PHIs haven't got access to this data to date, and some of the opportunities here. So firstly, this has already mostly been touched on, but just quickly wanted to touch on the use of My Health Record as it stands. So primary use is for provisioning healthcare, as Adam and Ailey have discussed. So healthcare professionals have full access to this data, as do patients. The government has also outlined a secondary objective for My Health Record, and that's to benefit the Australian health system by ensuring that patients receive quality evidence-based care that is accessible and cost-effective. So to facilitate this secondary use, there is an intention to make de-identified data from My Health Record, so that's kind of summarised with no personal information in it, make this available to approved researchers or other kind of government officials. So this, however, no movement has been made to date in this space. It is subject to ongoing establishment of governance arrangements and a proof of concept system, which kind of there was a bit of movement on it in 2018 and 2021, but nothing substantial has kind of come out of this space. So, Finally, there are a few prohibited uses. I think these went in a change to the Act in 2018. So Ailey kind of touched on this. The use of My Health Record for provisioning insurance is completely prohibited. So that includes underwriting, determining coverage, deciding whether to cover or not, and pricing, things like that. In addition to this, in the Act, private health insurers are specifically called out as being prohibited from both primary and secondary access to My Health Record, and this is regardless of any consent given by an individual. In 2018, before this change went into the Act, there were discussions, as Adam touched on, between insurers, insurance bodies and the government around gaining access for PHIs. However, the government maintained this prohibition on all insurers, kind of with their focus on building trust and confidence in the My Health Record system, which definitely made sense at the time, and I'll touch on this a little bit more later on. But first of all, why do private health insurers want access to My Health Record? So just curious, can I get a little show of hands of who's a private health insurance actuary in the room or has pretty good experience in private health insurance? Okay, so a bit of a mix here. So we'll just quickly touch on kind of private health insurance a little bit. I'm sure most people will vaguely know this, but in Australia, private health insurance is community rated. So this means that everyone is entitled to purchase the same product for the same price and is guaranteed the right to renew. So unlike other insurances, private health insurance can't price discriminate based on risk, and you can't decline coverage to anyone that wants to take out an open for sale product. This means that even if private health insurers did gain access to My Health Record data and there wasn't the prohibition in the Act, they wouldn't be able to use it for pricing or underwriting purposes because of this community-rated system. So if we can't use it for pricing, why do private health insurers want access? Kind of what are the use cases here? So largely, there's a few use cases. I'm just going to touch on three kind of examples here. But most of the use cases centre around improving quality of care in the system and reducing the cost of the system, which will in turn kind of reduce premiums. One example here is in the prevention space. So the PHI industry currently spends between $50 and $60 million per year on preventative health or health management type of programs. So these are programs that typically target members with high-cost chronic conditions, and they aim to keep people out of hospital for longer or reduce the severity of admissions. So both improve quality of life and reduce hospitalisation costs. However, PHIs run into a problem when implementing these programs due to data access. So a lot of the time, health insurers don't actually know what health issues members have until either just before they go into hospital, until after they come out of hospital and we get a claim. My Health Record provides a really strong opportunity here for health insurers to identify these members earlier on in the cycle, such as after GP visits or certain tests, things like that, and more effectively intervene early and drive better outcomes and cost savings. Another use case is to improve clinical outcomes here. So this is through how private health insurers contract with healthcare providers. So traditionally, health insurers have a pay-for-service type of model. So yeah, you pay for a claim regardless kind of the outcomes of it. However, increasingly, insurers are wanting to move towards more outcomes-based contracting. And we heard from Susie in the plenary yesterday about how SVA has used outcomes-based contracting in a completely different industry and some of the successes they've had in that space. So found that really interesting. It's good to see how well this can work in other industries and how applicable it is here as well. Similarly to the prevention problem, there are challenges with data when it comes to measuring outcomes. So private health insurers, they're currently moving towards this space, but the data they have available right now is pretty limited to things like readmissions. So that's just claims behaviour when people go back into hospital after other admissions, or things like patient surveys, like patient reported their experience and their outcomes that they've had. So a broader range of data would improve the ability for private health insurers to kind of have more effective outcomes-based contracting. The last one just touch on is forecasting and prediction. So more data, better forecasting, better prediction, and health insurers can kind of better prioritise how they fund different prevention programs, how they approach their outcomes-based contracting. So looking at kind of the reasons why private health insurers want access, they seem like pretty positive reasons. Generally, kind of win-wins for insurers and consumers, both from a quality of care and a cost perspective. And it's also aligned with the government's secondary objective we spoke about just before around improving quality and accessibility. So what are the concerns? Why have private health insurers not been successful in getting access. So one key concern here is data security. We've touched on this extensively. Health information is very sensitive, and sharing this more broadly poses significant security risks. It's quite topical, actually, in the industry. There's been an increasing instance of cyber attacks that we see on private healthcare companies, both in Australia and a lot in the US. So Medibank, everyone will probably be aware of the issues there in 2022. United Health is also a significant, they had a significant cyber breach in February this year. The second concern is kind of the misuse of information. Similarly, there's a lot of high-profile examples here that we've seen. I don't know if anyone's heard of care.data. So that was a UK system that was very, very similar to My Health Record. It was abolished in 2016 before it even got off the ground, and this was largely due to concerns around data sharing. So their care.data system was set up, and it would allow insurers, all insurers and other companies, to apply for and purchase access to the data. This kind of caused a bit of public outcry and eventually ended up in the system kind of falling over, having to reassess, and it's got back up on its feet now under a different name and different governance structures. One of the key differences here is that in the UK, private health insurers can price discriminate, so that was a big concern in that space. Another example kind of misuse of information that we're seeing is sharing with third parties when consent either hasn't been given or it's not clear that consent has been given. So a couple of examples late last year around Better Health and Cerebral. These are online mental health kind of counselling platforms. They got into a bit of trouble recently for sharing individuals' data with social media sites like Facebook and Instagram for targeted advertising. So they kind of got a slap on the wrist and nothing really was done about it, but the information has already been shared. So definitely very valid concerns around here. However, just on the other side of the slide, I wanted to touch on some of the recent research, which shows quite promising public sentiment towards PHIs. So in 2018, a digital health startup, as part of all these changes, ran a survey of individuals, and they found that 89% of people would be willing to share their information with private health insurers if it helped improve outcomes and costs. So that's a good sign. More recently, Ipsos research in 2023 showed that trust in private health insurers has increased significantly over the last 4 years. So around half of people have high or very high trust in their PHIs. And this is much higher than other industries such as general insurers, banks, and even government. One final factor that I want to touch on very briefly is concerns largely from the healthcare space around so-called kind of managed care and PHIs having too much control over care pathways. There's lots of arguments. We could talk about this topic for a long time, but we won't. I just wanted to highlight one point here, which is a challenge that private health insurers will have to contend with, that trust in healthcare providers, so this includes hospitals, both private and public, is significantly greater than private health insurers. And if insurers kind of want to gain access to data, have more influence on care pathways, this is a challenge they're going to have to contend with. So I'm going to hand over to Ailey. That kind of wraps up some of the private health insurers, why we want access, some of the concerns. So Ailey's going to have a chat about opportunities that we've identified with consideration for kind of some of the challenges that we're facing.
So in light of all of that, we took a step back when we were preparing this presentation in terms of, it's clear we need to sort of walk before we can run. There are big, big opportunities for private health and the health system in general if you get My Health Record and health data sharing right. But there needs to be a way to go about it in terms of getting the right trust and the right foundations there in the beginning. And that was almost what happened in terms of the opt-in to opt-out transition. So we were looking at the problem or trying to come at it from a different angle. And ultimately what we got to is the first step is potentially just, can private health insurers put data into this system? And then what benefits would there be if that existed? So the first sort of pretty obvious one is, could they or are there opportunities if we're just putting in the patient's coverage information? So they are with us as a health insurer, they're on this level of product, and potentially that covers this thing. Part of the roadmap that Adam alluded to way back in the beginning is they're really looking about making My Health Record something that integrates with other tools, something that allows different systems to talk to each other. So if there are systems and there is cases where, for example, private health insurers have put information into GP practice management systems that indicate, you know, we cover these preventative programs, the patient would need to meet, you know, these criteria, need to have this cover. If we could link all of this up, if we could say the GP now already knows that the patient has this health insurance with this level of cover that covers these programs, their practice management software is telling you, all right, well, then these programs are available, and, oh, look, this patient has just been, say, diagnosed with the early signs of osteoarthritis. What that could then do is the GP is the driver of the care. We're no longer reliant on the PHIs trying to identify people just before admissions when it's possibly too late already to get them into some sort of preventative program. The GP can steer them to these programs that the private health insurer is willing to cover. With the osteoarthritis example, this is one that sort of comes up a lot in our work. So there's a program that a lot of private health insurers use where if just 1 in 12 participants in this preventative program avoid a knee replacement for osteoarthritis, there's savings to the health system. In reality, it's actually much higher than that, the success rates. So, but the challenge is very much identifying people at the right point to get them into these programs. So even just by putting data in, by achieving some of the goals around integrating these different platforms, we could really ramp up some of the savings in this type of area for the benefit of the patient. They're avoiding an invasive procedure, and for the benefit of the health system, it's a cost saving which gets passed on through lower premiums. As an extension of this, GPs are effectively the navigator for patients through the health system. You know, if you've got a condition, you're going to your GP first. They're then going to be referring you to your specialists and things that then sort of, that is the determinant of where you end up in terms of either public but also private care. With this integration of systems, we do also, private health insurers also currently share information on, oh, this doctor's no gap or this doctor's got a known gap. And usually there are tools that would indicate approximately what that gap would be. But that then relies on patients getting referrals to those specific doctors, and GPs don't always have the information in front of them in terms of what insurer you're with. And then they would have to be juggling between the different insurers in terms of those coverage information platforms and tools. There is an opportunity here, again, to integrate all of these things. If they now know, okay, you're with this health fund, either then they can go to that health fund, or if there was even better, a platform that brought all that information together and brought it into something like a practice management tool, the GPs can guide their patients to fully covered doctors or to lower gap settings, lower cost options for the benefit of the patient, because then they're not going to have a surprise out of pocket, but for the benefit of the system in general as well, if you're going for lower cost pathways. And this is just putting information in. This isn't even to do with anything about primary or secondary use. So this is the potentially horizon one or option one in terms of garnering that trust and building up some of those opportunities for My Health Record. I'll pass to Olivia to talk about the next space.
Thank you. So after we had to think about opportunities for health insurers to put in, we thought, okay, maybe if health insurers can gain enough trust to get just secondary de-identified access, what are the opportunities here? And we think there are still significant benefits. One of the big benefits we think is in the outcomes-based contracting space that I spoke about before. You'd have to approach it differently with the secondary de-identified data. I think one of the big opportunities that health insurers would love to do is have specific provider information and kind of be able to look at different providers who has better outcomes and, adjust contracting structures based on that. There's a whole host of issues with that. So this one kind of looks at it more from a procedure type perspective. Having that holistic view of the patient journey can definitely broaden our ability to kind of look at different procedures. One good example here is identifying low-value care. A good example recently that we've seen that's a bit topical was ABC Four Corners did a report into spinal fusion surgeries. I don't know if anyone has seen that, but the report kind of pulls together various different disparate bits of information. So there was a study from a UK-based company that pulled de-identified data from private health insurers and identified significant fraud, waste, and abuse in these procedures. There's also several government studies that look at comparing the public and the private system, and that a disproportionate amount of these types of surgeries go through the private system and indicating that there's potential overuse in the system, and even examining the need for these surgeries and whether they deliver good outcomes or not. So it just kind of shows, if you pull together lots of different bits of information, you can find out a lot more. And if private health insurers kind of had access, they would be able to do these things themselves. Another good example is evaluating the effectiveness of lower cost care pathways. So this is happening already. Private health insurers are doing this a lot. A good example is chemo at home, which is where most insurers will fund this, which is where members can get chemotherapy in the comfort of their own home, benefits them. It's cheaper than in an in-hospital setting. And there's been significant research that shows that outcomes are just as good with these types of services. So by having access to kind of that broader range of data, insurers can better evaluate and look proactively for these lower cost care settings and drive kind of some of these changes in the system. Finally, more health data could lead to some better long-term planning. And this is one of the government's intentions with kind of making this data available to researchers. A good example of this is in mental health services. So the public shortage has kind of pushed a lot of this burden into the private system. However, anyone that knows anything about private health insurance will know that there's prices of gold tier products, which are the products that cover mental health, have increased by something like 40% over the last 4 years. So actually the funding in the private system of these services is moving towards unsustainable and risk being inaccessible to many members. So kind of better end-to-end views of this type of information can lead to better planning, so we don't kind of come into these situations and then have to fix them at the end. And yeah, as I mentioned, a lot of this type of work could actually be completed by independent bodies and don't require private health insurers to have access to the data. However, it does rely on, kind of we touched on before, the government being able to establish these governance arrangements and also prioritising and funding the work. While on the other hand, private health insurers kind of have the means and the motivation to do a lot of this work themselves. So yeah, lots of opportunities that we have here. I'm going to pass to Adam just to kind of a little wrap up of everything we spoke about.
Thanks, Olivia. So we've talked about what My Health Record is and what the government and digital health agencies is aiming for in the short term future for a system that ultimately shows a lot of promise but remains flawed, whether through data security concerns, being a relatively clunky system, or a lack of industry-wide uptake across all information aspects that My Health Record contains. However, ultimately, My Health Record presents the opportunity for the health system to use the improved digital and data landscape that it provides to better itself in the outcomes for members. The desire for health insurers to gain access to a level of this data can bring an even greater impact to this. However, despite community sentiment trending favourably for members welcoming health insurers to gain access to their healthcare data, we believe that to build trust, the most practical initial approach would be for health insurers to put data into the system and give GPs a patient's health insurance information to be able to guide patients to low-cost and low-gap options, as opposed to take data out of the system. As a potential next step beyond simply putting data into the system, insurers could use secondary or de-identified data to accomplish a variety of benefits to the health system, including broadening the ability to evaluate quality care to prevent widespread fraud and waste, improve assessments of the effectiveness of lower cost care pathways, and for the long-term planning for health needs. We believe that there are significant opportunities for private health insurance and healthcare in general through My Health Record, and that the opportunities we have presented are palatable and bring benefits that share incredible synergy with the already defined roadmap for digital health. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam, Olivia and Ailey for that. So we have a couple of questions which have come in on the app. And if you do have a burning question, type it in now or else I'll roam around after this. So Alan sort of wants to know, if a patient can select specific information not to be updated to the electronic health record, and if they do, does a user of this, or a GP or a private health insurer, eventually be able to identify that there is missing data?
So it's more a matter around the kind of locking of the base functionality. So an individual has access to, you know, kind of restrict access to providers, and then it's merely a matter of the providers simply not being able to update that information. So when, obviously, we don't have the data to look at, but the assumption would be when you look at the data, it's simply just kind of got holes that you can't fill in, and it's just restrictions that are entirely there and under the sort of discretion of the individual.
So I think what it sounds like is you can't pick and choose what information is shared. You kind of share your whole record with your provider or not. Is that kind of, yeah?
Yeah, there's tiers to it, but it is effectively sort of a... Well,
yeah.
It is effectively sort of...
Sorry, my question.
Yeah.
Does that mean if you go to a different doctor, let's say you see somebody about depression, mm-hmm. you can, and that's different to your normal GP, you can have that removed.
So it's more around the GP ultimately can choose what they're sort of uploading. So you could liaise with them and see if they're uploading that information. The choice to sort of lock or not is more around a holistic sense of do you want the data to be there or not. But obviously on a more discretionary basis, you could talk to the GP if it's around something like depression. And then that could still remain a sort of private conversation that doesn't get recorded. And then obviously that wouldn't transfer to a new GP or something like that. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. So we put a question from Anna. We are good at defining low-value care? Do we have a clear definition of what high-value care looks like and how do we measure that?
I think there's some very obvious examples of low-value care. The one that Olivia mentioned from Four Corners quite recently was one where, you know, there was clear examples of fraud even. So that's probably, it's probably even slightly different to low-value care. That's just fraud. But I think that's where the data and things on outcomes is actually how we're going to get better at doing that. I think we are in the early stages. There's definitely a view and there's definitely, I guess, what would be called low-hanging fruit in terms of procedures that people know are problematic. But this is, it's information like this that's getting the fuller picture that it's actually going to improve, I think, that work on a longer-term basis.
And I think maybe the term low-value care sounds quite bad. There's a spectrum, I guess, of the value of care. And as we progress, I mean, something that 10 years ago might have been higher-value care might be low-value care now due to technological advancements. So it's something that's constantly changing. And yeah, the best, like Ailey touched on, the best way we're going to assess this is just with more data and time to see outcomes.
And a question from Martin. The risk returned case for PHI access to the mental health record seems compelling. What needs to happen for that access to be granted?
Yeah. I think what we were trying to do with the way we sort of, I guess, laid out the presentation is there needs to be the foundations, the data security. So, I mean, I think part of the problem or one of the challenges I think we'll now face is post-Medibank hack. I think insurers are going to have to do a lot more to demonstrate that the data security part is there. And then I think it's going to be the process of building the trust. So and demonstrating that we can use the information for good in terms of better outcomes for patients, lower costs for patients, lower premiums for patients, before we're even getting into that primary use, you know, identifiable information, or potentially even accepting that might not happen, and compromising for things that will still provide those benefits.
Yeah, I think further to that, an opportunity could be in the future is to potentially move to some kind of starting with, well, taking a step back, I think it's the right decision to not allow insurers access initially. You need to build trust in the system. There was already concerns around this information being kind of collected centrally, and then sharing it wider could have just derailed the whole program, as we saw in the UK. So that was the right decision. I think as we move forward, we get more trust. There's potential to move into kind of an opt-in model, so where insurers might get access, but only if people specifically say, yes, I want my insurer to have access, and then insurers can kind of do what they want to do with that to encourage people to kind of give them access. But like Ailey said, yeah, some very fundamental things that will need to be addressed to give people confidence to do that. I think we're a little bit of a ways away from that, but definitely opportunities.
All right. I know it's the bell for lunch, so if everyone will indulge in my additional questions, that'd be great. I'm going to ask one. So assuming that this is granted and PHIs get access to the My Health Record, you saw that you presented a stat that $50 to $60 million is already spent on preventative health. That's a very small drop in a $20 billion claim bucket. What else do you think would need to be done to sort of help incentivize PHIs to do this other than potential cost savings down the line?
Do we need incentives other than cost savings?
It's retention as well.
Well, yeah, I think it's also the value to members. I think one of the things that PHIs have to do at the moment is, rather than identify members, it's almost sell members on the preventative program. So it's almost telling them that they're there. You know, you're in an age demographic, or you're in a, you know, you've claimed for something that's not directly related, but we don't have any other information, so we're doing our best. We're going to tell you about these programs and sell you on these programs. So I think in that way, it's also about a value proposition to members.
And I think what could be really helpful as well, often PHIs, it can be like a little bit of a battle with GPs as well, to sometimes they feel like we're intervening in their space, and also educating some GPs can be quite traditional in the way that they work, and a lot of these programs are very, very new. So yeah, educating GPs, and if GPs could get on board with some of these programs, that kind of helps encourage kind of PHIs to fund more, and yeah, just the better education generally around the system and measurement of outcomes. And to really show those cost savings. Because, yeah, like you mentioned, it's tiny, tiny amounts.
Before you hand over, I'm going to throw in one extra spanner.
Okay, yeah. Oh, great.
Clean slate. We're in a very regulated industry. How would you change our regulations or sort of structure of the industry to sort of help incentivize that even further?
I think it's an interesting, when you look at the top level, it's very much a... There's the value proposition of wanting to be a bit more of a partnered with your members as opposed to just sort of sitting there and paying claims. So in terms of the, maybe not so much a regulation point of view, but, and I'm not sure if there's any regulation points from Ailey or Olivia that want to add, but more so from a sort of industry standpoint, it's very much a, you can have sort of one or two insurers try and make a bit of a change in this space, but it's very much something that to really drive change, you need to sort of push from the industry ground up. And whether that's something that then requires some sort of legislation and regulation changes to sort of be in line with that, or there's potential reforms that can try and do things to, you know, we've touched on gold as a bit of a problem point, whether there's reforms that can be implemented to try and reduce there or to shift this sort of conversation. But it is fundamentally something that requires the whole industry to drive forward, I would imagine.
Just one opportunity I can think of that's actually not too crazy and not too kind of rewriting the whole system is... potentially, as we look at risk equalisation and how that works, is there an opportunity to kind of reward insurers for offering more of these types of services through risk equalisation, so better, maybe higher ratios of kind of sharing amongst these costs? Yeah, that's one idea.
Great. And one last question from Bonnie. So are discussions with government ongoing to try and arrive at a solution for private health insurers to access this data, or is it sort of fallen under the radar?
As far as I can tell, it's kind of, there was a lot of discussion, I think, NIB, Medibank, PHA in 2018 before they wrote into the Act that explicitly prohibiting private health insurers. There was lots of discussions to try and stop that. But since then, I haven't seen or heard very much about anything to do with My Health Record, to be honest. But, yeah.
What I will add is there was a little bit of discussion last year. So strengthening Medicare as part of the budget last year was this, so the $430 million of funding that we talked about quite early on is part of that. So it's a holistic piece around trying to, you know, bolster Medicare for the future as we sort of face into an aging population and other things. And there was then a little bit of early discussion about the role of private health insurers in that. Some of that was more on the side of, is there a role for private health insurers to fund or get more involved in sort of that primary care with GPs. So there's the edge of an opportunity there. I think that's the very beginning of, if we do have that conversation, we can also, or we would need to bring some of this into the frame about, yes, you know, potentially private health insurers are interested in funding some of that, but then we would also need to be looking at getting some of the data. So I don't think it's happening right now, but I think the opportunity is there.
Great. All right. We'll, given the angry bells, we'll call it there. So join me in thanking Ailey, Olivia and Adam on their presentation today.